This is another iRaw podcast.
I think the urban is a place where we have a lot of these animals that are just not paid attention to. They are so much part of the wallpaper of our lives.
Welcome to season 3 of the Animal Turn podcast with me, Claudia Herzenfelder. This season, we're talking all about animals and the urban. And today is episode 3, where we're talking about the concept invisibilized animals. Super important concept, and Paula Kari, my guest, is absolutely amazing. But before I introduce her, let's just do a spot of housekeeping. Straight away, I wanted to say I'm sorry that this episode was a bit delayed in coming out. Things have been a bit crazy on my end. I'm currently moving countries. I'm moving from Canada to Austria, and it's the end of semester, and I've just kind of been bogged down with grading, literally grading coming out of my eyes and ears at the moment. So it's just led to a couple of delays. I also wanted to just say thank you at the front of this episode to Animals and Philosophy, Politics and Law and Ethics Apple for sponsoring this podcast. If you haven't checked out their website, you should definitely go and have a look. There's so much exciting work happening at Apple, and they're just wonderful people, wonderful folks. And I just wanted to say a thank you right up front to you guys once again. And a special thank you to Paula Simonik, who's also a member at Apple. She donated her Blue Yeti microphone to me. For those of you who have been listening to the podcast since the beginning, you'll know that in season 1 and for a big chunk of season 2, I was having a lot of sound issues, building myself blanket forts and figuring out a whole variety of ways in which to make my sound better. And Paulina has since given me a microphone, and I hope that you've noticed, but things have improved quite a bit. On that note, however, there are a few sound disruptions in this episode. You'll hear that there's some furniture moving in the background, and you're definitely going to hear the distinct sound of a dog shaking their body. You know, when the collar, the tag on the collar goes tick, 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 tick. So you're definitely going to hear that. Sorry, unfortunately, there are some sounds that when recording from home are unavoidable, but it's not too jarring. And I think you're going to hear Paula and myself just fine. Okay, so enough of all of that. Let's get to today's episode. Today I'm speaking to Paula Kari, who's a Leverhulme Early Career Research Fellow within the Centre for Human-Animal Studies at Edgehill University in the UK. Her 3-year project, The Visual Consumption of Animals, Challenging Persistent Binaries, aims to support transformational change in the ways humans conceive and interact with nature. Before joining Edgehill, Paula worked at the RMIT University in Melbourne on a range of climate change projects and completed a PhD there in 2018. She's primarily interested in the relationship between societal change and stability in relation to climate change and environmental change, as well as how this is part of expropriating nature and involves the oppression of non-human animals. All right. Hi, Paula. Is it Paula or Paula?
Paula.
Paula. Hi, yeah. Paula. Welcome to the Animal Turn.
Thank you. Thanks, Claudia. Is it Claudia or Claudia?
Yeah, I'm easy either way. Technically Claudia, but I kind of, I've been in too many German circles to kind of notice the difference. Claudia and Claudia, whichever. It is interesting, right? As soon as you have that AU combination, people aren't quite sure. Yes. Paula and Claudia or Paula and Claudia. Anyway, I'm digressing already in the beginning of the show. it's lovely, lovely, lovely to have you on the Animal Turn. And I'm so excited to talk to you about the concept today, which is invisibilized animals. But first, before we get into that, I just wanted to actually speak to you a bit about why you think the urban is an important place for us to study when thinking about animals, and maybe how you yourself came to be interested in the urban as a place of consideration.
Well, it was a place of consideration, I guess, just for a more recent paper that I've done. My interest does go more broadly than that. But I guess it started when I was in Melbourne, and there was a real kind of heightening interest in sort of, and I guess it's part of where, because I was living in the city and I was part of a very urban campus, university campus, but there was a lot of work on urban biodiversity, urban nature conservation, how to get communities concerned with nature. And it kind of struck me that there was large numbers of animals, because I lived out in a suburb about maybe 10 kilometers from the center, and there were slaughterhouses all around me. And mm-hmm. I was always very conscious whenever I was heading out of the city or heading anywhere, I would be passing livestock trucks all the time. And so there was just a sort of disconnect for me with these kind of feel good, romanticized efforts around nature and biodiversity of the city. And then that kind of came up against, you know, these slaughterhouses and like blank, sterile places of that were hiding violence behind them. And then that made me also, I lived very close to the zoo within walking distance. I moved very close to the zoo. Mm-hmm. It's another big group of contained animals in our cities, and also very close to Flemington racetrack, horse racing. And then annually there's this bull riding event that tours Australia and goes into stadiums in the middle of cities. And there's sort of rodeo aspects to that as well. And I just started to think about all of these animals that get sucked into our urban lives that were excluded from these discussions of nature. Mm-hmm. But I thought they're just equally nature. And of course, animals in rescue centers as well, animals in research centers, the horse carriages. And so that's just really what got me focused on the urban. And even if they aren't located there, the urban is such a transit zone for animals. At some point in their kind of commodified lives, they're passing through the city, often in a different form for the case of food animals. But yeah, so that was why the nature became a focus for me. And also because in Eric Schwindow, I don't know how to say his name properly, but
there's a lot of W's in that name.
Yes. Yeah, I get confused. He talks about the urban cities as really the catalysts, the kind of the places where our activities, the metabolism of our activities is sort of centered in cities, even though we draw on the rest of the world. It's kind of the processes are feeding the urban activities, really. So, yeah.
And was it, so was the urban part of your PhD work, or is this a side project?
It kind of came out of that, I think. Like, I guess a lot of things do. Your thinking starts to move along. I had looked at ethical and sustainable meat, and I had been interviewing urban participants, and I guess the phenomenon of ethical and sustainable meat, and I know that it's got a slightly different guise in different parts of the world, but in Australia there was particularly a rise in self-identified products and consumers of ethical and sustainable meat. It was actually labeled like that, and say humane meat or ethical or more sustainable. And a lot of that activity is centered on urban food markets. And so that's how I approached my consumers and producers, because the urban markets were there, where the exchange took place, and where the construction of the ethical was being performed, like yeah. Both the ethical meat and the ethical animals. So the producers and consumers were sort of meeting in these urban markets.
When you said sustainable, I just watched Seaspiracy, I think, last week. It's busy trending everywhere and kind of starting to question some of these labels. And I actually went on a bit of a rant, I think, with my husband this morning, because I saw a massive billboard for, I think it was McDonald's, for a fast food chain, and just a massive picture of a beef burger. And this is also another way in which animals are in our cities, right, as representations of things. but like sustainably sourced. And of all the things to have the word sustainable next to, a beef patty just seemed remarkable. I didn't know how this was being achieved, like how it was just being so readily accepted, that idea. So what fascinating work. So your PhD was kind of looking at these ethical interactions, and from that you realized that there's a really significant and important urban dimension to all of this.
Yes, yes. And I guess the urban is also where these the seeds of these sort of ways that meat is reconstituted, I guess the urban is where that tends to emerge. The ethical concerns start to bubble up most in urban cities, I think. It's interesting what you last said. I was just emailing with a colleague in Australia this morning, and she was saying how now in America that reconstitution of meat in response to public concerns has shifted to antibiotic use. So now you're getting meat labeled as
antibiotic-free.
As not, yes, mm-hmm. yes.
So. There are these just like interesting things. I'm in Canada at the moment, and it seems to be kind of the fact that the meat is Canadian is really important. The fact that it's antibiotic free and the fact that it's sustainable just comes up again and again, which, yeah, it's interesting to think through. So were you always interested in animals and how they interact in your research, or is this, you know, what was your pathway to getting to animals?
It's relatively recent. I kind of feel I came to it too late, as I guess many people do, that they wish their light had switched on earlier. But I really started, mind you, I've been vegetarian since I was 16. And that was for that was for ethical reasons, but my ethics had just went to that limit of dairy for a long time till I was in my 30s, and I studied climate and climate change, environmental science. That was my background, and I worked in climate change adaptation and mitigation for a few years, and it was increasingly the case that the groups of people I was working for weren't vegetarian. There was maybe a couple of us in groups of 30 or 40 that were vegetarian, and yet this was the time when the contribution of animal agriculture to climate change and environmental change was really quite irrefutable. Mm-hmm. And yet I just saw a kind of wall that went up that wasn't part of what we did. We did greenhouse gas emissions from utilities, and we did transport, and we also looked at water. But food, but the sustainability of food was maybe part of it, but not animal agriculture. Mm. And in one of the institutes I was at, there was colleague there in a different area doing her own funded research. She was funded by Voiceless, actually, in Australia, and she was doing this qualitative research showing people pictures of factory farming and eliciting their response. And I actually had no idea that this kind of research was possible. I think I just came from such a quantitative hard science background that I hadn't really thought about qualitative research. I didn't really know that was possible. It was amazing to me. So it was a bad time for climate change research, as I guess it was for many kind of research centers around 2010, around that time. And our funding kind of dried up, and many of us went on to do PhDs. And my mind had sort of been opened up by this world of critical animal studies that I didn't know about, and it just felt like my space. Mm. I just discovered it, and so I went for it.
I like what you say there, because I have definitely noticed a similar tension myself. One of the beauties of geography is geography does somewhat straddle this kind of qualitative quantitative divide. So sometimes in the same department, you'll have people that are working on, you know, greenhouse gases and doing very technical things that, you know, speak in a language I don't quite understand. And sometimes us from the social side will stand up and we start using words, which we'll talk a bit about later in the episode, like entanglement and relationality, that they struggle to understand. But at the very least, we're in the same room or at the same buildings where we're able to start to share some of these ideas, which is really important. But I have been somewhat startled by how often I speak to folks that are doing climate change research, that are at the forefront of looking at the Arctic and global warming, who have not thought about or even had animal agriculture as part of their syllabi. You know, how this forms part of all of these processes seems to be not only invisibilized in cities, but invisibilized in the way we even understand these massive problems. And I'm obviously speaking very broad brushstrokes here, but I've just been quite surprised at the leaders, the people that are knowledge generators about this, not having any sort of, and I'm not even just speaking here about ethical stand, I'm speaking about kind of the ecological impacts of animal agriculture here. It's quite...
Yes, exactly. When we talk, the last paper I wrote with Fiona Proben-Rapsey and Hayley Singer, we touched on that in terms of the climate movement often being quite resistant to having any sort of animal message brought in. And I guess part of it is fear of alienating some of their support base. So that's partly it. But I think there's also... the invisibilization is kind of can be understood in different ways, and I think it's that kind of that invisibilization as a process that I'm kind of interested in. So it's not that things are or are not visible, but it's how they're rendered kind of discursively and conceptually and as part of epistemically. And I think what you were just talking about for me points to that epistemic invisibility. So the way our systems of knowledge have been built around the naturalization of the subordinated status of animals, like it's just set up as a natural state of being, much like other subordinated humans are their subordination is naturalized. It's the same for animals, that it's just construed as a natural thing, and that's it suffuses all our systems of knowledge, and they determine how animals can be understood and made sense of in our everyday practices. And so that's a kind of, that's a structural invisibility. It goes through all of our societies at every level and dimension: law, policy, governance, education, media, religion, families. It normalizes their constitutions as functional, like based on their function, their utilitary function. So it normalizes those constitutions so that they are effectively invisible in any other way.
Yeah, I'm happy you brought up your paper there. So this is what we're going to talk about today, kind of invisibilized animals. And I think you bring a lot of these tensions out. Let me make sure I get the name correct. Where species don't meet, invisibilized animals, urban nature and city limits. Now, I thought this was an incredibly provocative paper, but you were saying, I think, things that everybody should know and things that people should question. So perhaps you could tell us maybe before I start asking questions about some of the concepts there, what was the premise of this paper? You did a massive literature review, but what was the main premise behind this paper?
It started off as what I was saying earlier, kind of observation about this body of literature around entanglement and human-animal relations. And relations is always understood in that positive way. Like a relation is always almost assumed to be reciprocal. It's always understood as sort of something a bit benign or benevolent. It's not always, but that's the dominant understanding of a relation. And I felt that there was something, the critical side was missing from these sort of articulations of careful, more ethical human relations with nature,
mm-hmm.
that I felt was kind of skating over commodified relations. They were talking about wildlife and nature, but again, the very violent and problematic relations we have with commodified animals were sidelined.
Yeah.
Or I think we say offstaged in the paper.
Is the title of your paper, Where Species Don't Meet, is that a tip or a tip of the hat or a challenge to the title When Species Meet from Donna Haraway's book?
Yes, it is. Because, yes, I mean...
She popularized or contributed greatly to this kind of idea of entanglement, and we're in relation, what you're talking about here. And I think... So, yeah, maybe we can talk a little bit about entanglement. So you say entanglement's being used in this kind of really positive way, that if you're in relation with someone, it's good. And I think that there has been a lot of value, I think, from animal studies in highlighting this and trying to say that, firstly, we need to recognize that we are in relationship with animals. It's not animals. It's not just this static thing where animal is a thing and we just happen to be in the same space, but actually how we understand ourselves and how they understand themselves is born of a relationship. And I think that that is a valuable thing to know. I think a lot of people maybe don't even go that far. Maybe with their own dogs and cats, they would appreciate that there's a relationship, but they don't necessarily think that they're in relation with the squirrel that hangs out in their tree or the raccoon that burrows in their roof. But I think I get what you're saying here, though, is that there is this kind of positive slant of saying once we recognize that we're entangled, something good will happen and we will look after these animals. We'll say, okay, we are in relation. We use the same spaces. So how can we develop better policies for those animals? But we've tended to focus very much on kind of these urban wildlife animals or liminal animals like squirrels and raccoons. And I guess the question then comes, how do we are cows and pigs and chickens not part of nature? Are they not part of the city because we don't see them in many North American cities? And I'm assuming what is it like in Australia? Are you likely to see pigs and cows and chickens in your cities?
No, much the same as Britain as well, where I am now. Like most places, they're contained. If they're in part of extensive systems, then they're in rural areas. But if they're part of more intensive systems, sometimes they're located in close to urban centres, like not far from where I am now. There's a large egg-laying, big sheds of laying hens that are just invisible to the outside. They're just these sterile sheds. So, yeah, they're mostly invisible, but I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to, I keep forgetting what your question was, but.
Sorry, I tend to load way too much into it.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I think it's more a matter of kind of this idea. So you mentioned nature, right? And I think when we speak about entanglement, we tend to privilege specific types of animals. But we tend to exclude other animals. So in your research, what are you finding in terms of the animals who are included in our way of thinking about urban entanglements and the animals that are excluded? Which animals are included in this and which are kind of left out?
Well, if we're talking about the particular sort of conservation biology, urban studies sort of framework, it does tend to be the animals conceived as wild, native, commensal. It can even extend to the stray and the feral and the pest, but it is definitely the more commodified animals whose use is just part of our everyday lives, that they're not as visible as something to problematize. Mm-hmm. That seems to be more left to animal advocacy to speak on their behalf. It seems to be relegated to a different set of concerns, and even just not viewed as problematic. I mean, even, and what you were saying about relations and entanglements, and going back to Donna Haraway, I mean, the relationship with her working dogs that she describes, that, like, pets is another area where the sorts of entanglements that are taken for granted need to be problematized as well. I mean, we have all these shelters that are part of our urban landscapes, and sort of what that means and the implications of them tend to not get discussed as the dominant narrative is sort of, especially in the UK, is sort of as a nation of pet lovers, and yet these industries, the pet industry, it is a huge industry that churns out and encourages breeders to keep supplying these animals into a market kind of based on the commodification of companionship and affection and even status and entertainment, that doesn't get problematized as much either. So even pets, but I mean, I was going to mention the racing industries and the zoo industry and say animals for research. I mean, these are the ones that aren't as visible, but it even extends to the relationships that are viewed as probably the most benign and benevolent, like pet keeping. I mean, it's interesting that in most countries, keeping native animals as pets is illegal, but you can have an exotic pet, so which is strange.
That is interesting. When you're speaking about invisibilized animals here, are we talking about specific species or animals? Or are we speaking about the invisibilization of specific forms of relationships? So, you know, could you have in the literature, and here we're primarily speaking, I guess, about how animals have been invisibilized in academic literature, in animal studies in general. But so you could have a rat who's conceivably part of what we've categorized as a pest and has come up quite a lot in literature and in thinking about cities and the ways in which cities are ecologies and natures. But you might also very well have a rat who's in a laboratory and that relationship is invisible. So it's not so much that rats themselves are invisible in all the literature as much as it is that form of relationship that is invisible, and the more invisible it is, what does that invisibility of that relationship then mean? Is it a matter of once we make it visible, things will be good?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point that I wanted to make at some point, and you reminded me. It's important to sort of question that, like visual concealment, like it does contribute to the conceptual and moral invisibility, in terms of, so when you speak of the popular conception of slaughterhouses and animal farms being outside of cities and invisible, and of research animals being invisible, so actual visual concealment does contribute to some extent to that conceptual and moral invisibility, but particularly with the advance of technologies, I think we actually need to trouble what that implies, which is that the greater visibility, then you'd have positive change. You know, that kind of ties in with that old Linda McCartney's thing of having glass, if slaughterhouses glass, mm-hmm. had glass walls. And because I think we need to question that, particularly with the increasing visual technologies that have been allowing most people over the last sort of 20 years to if they choose to, but it can be hard to avoid, but to be at least aware of the realities of a lot of these industries. They're much less, they're much more transparent now, that the activities are much less hidden. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's different types of visibility. Like you were saying, it's the it's different types of visibilization. It's not just the literal, what I would say is literal invisibility. So I would identify probably at least three other kinds of invisibility. So you've got that epistemic invisibility that I mentioned before, like our knowledge systems that just do not see them as anything other than their utilitarian designation. So as food animals, as pets, as entertainment. So that's their function. And then you've also got what I would call, as part of that, is a kind of ontological invisibility. So the kind of way that they're invisibilized in our knowledge systems, it actually precludes these animals having any self-directed ways of being, kind of undermines the idea that they are subjects of their own lives and parts of communities that aren't governed by humans. So you might think of von Uxkull's concept of Umwelt, which you'll be familiar with. So the idea that these animals, if they weren't subjected to human will, they would have lives that were their own to determine. They'd have free will and agency. They would have the ability to not relate to us, to leave a relation, to be something other than our perception and value of them. But we have removed that possibility. So I would refer to that as a kind of ontological invisibility. They haven't got their own presence or futures. And that applies to most commodified animals in our world right now. If I can say like another aspect of this, like bringing in a couple of other authors, but that aspect of them being severed from their communities, and it's not just those that have been taken from their natural habitats that I'm kind of thinking of here, but it includes captive bred and domesticated animals who progressively with each generation, they're kind of cut off from the inherited knowledge and instincts that kind of makes them what they are. And Deborah Bird Rose describes this as a sort of double death, where you have entire generations of living things and connectivities that are being destroyed. And she drew one of her ideas from a guy called James Hatley, who speaks about genocide and species extinction as enocide. And he similarly describes the kind of wiping out of entire generations that would have kind of carried forward their memories. So this way that we've kind of erased animals' own self-directed ways of being, it's kind of amounting to a progressive ontological invisibility. We can't see any other way of life for them. I mean, it kind of gets summed up in that common response you get from people is what would happen to all the animals? You know, what would happen to all the animals if we didn't use them as food, or if we didn't use them in this way, what else would they be?
I have to almost smile because it does, that comes up so often, kind of even there's almost a lack of imagination that cows might have something other to do than to stand in their own filth waiting for us to eat them. You know, maybe yeah. There's something else out there for cows and chickens. Maybe they have different agendas. You mentioned that there are three types of invisibilities. You said epistemic, yes, yeah. Ontological, and was the other representational? Yeah.
Well, I would say there's probably about five. I think it's probably five. So you've got the, yeah, it's hard and because it's not really a definite system. And then these are just kind of different ways of thinking about it that kind of indicate there's different things going on here. So I think there's the question of the literal visibility, which I'm saying doesn't always correlate with moral visibility. You know, the yeah. more visible they are, the more the better they'll be treated, because as I won't linger too long, I'll keep moving on. Yes, like because Timothy Patcherat and a couple of others have already pointed out that like sequestration and sight can coexist. Like mm-hmm. animals can be subjectified within their systems of objectification. We're quite okay with that. So that's probably the most common way of thinking about visibility in terms of that literal visibility. But then what you described earlier and what we come into contact with most every day is the discursive invisibility. And Carol Adams' notion of the absent referent is probably mm-hmm. the most kind of accessible notion of that, how language and discourse and images are used to effectively kind of make the living, breathing animal invisible, but also what's done to them becomes invisible, kind of shrouded in this veil of happy words and euphemistic words and animated happy images. So that's one type of discursive invisibility. And what you've been asking me about, like words like nature and other aggregate terms like biodiversity and non-human, they also work discursively to kind of exclude certain animals or just be vague about it. But then you have, as I was saying, the euphemistic terms used to describe certain things that are done to animals, like euthanasia or culling. Mm-hmm. And a friend the other day mentioned that, yes. And a friend the other day mentioned that when people go fishing, they buy what are called landing mats to be more friendly to the fish so that they don't suffer on the ground. So they're called
so interesting. Landing the kind mats. Of the cognitive dissonance that and we've all done it. I was quite proud of the amount of meat I would eat and kind of the interactions I'd have. In South Africa, we would frequently go to and again, thinking kind of about the relationship between the city and what's outside of the city, is we would frequently leave Johannesburg to go on a game drive just outside of the city to marvel at. I take it for granted, like I realize how much I took it for granted when I was in South Africa, now that I'm out, where we had access to seeing elephants, giraffes, zebra, and we would spend hours in our cars watching these animals, marveling at them, only to go back to our campsites and eat meat that had been bought from a supermarket in the store, right? And this kind of shows those flows as well. So the flesh, the meat had come from somewhere. We bought it in a supermarket, completely removed from the animal, very little thought about it being an animal, it was just a steak. Picked that up, took it outside of the city again, sat in a place that we all went to because we love nature. And you can have these ambivalent feelings at exactly the same time. You're like, yes, I love nature. Animals are amazing. They're awe-inspiring. Look at that elephant as he walks up the road and blocks all the cars and just takes charge of that space. And you think, yes, animals are amazing. And we're all busy marveling at how awesome animals are as we chomp on a chop and we eat a steak. And it's interesting how you do have that kind of barrier to thinking of these animals, but also in a very material sense, how they relate to the city in very different ways. That elephant in the park is very differently. I think that elephant in the park is still in relationship to Johannesburg, is still impacted by whatever goes on in Johannesburg. But the cow that I'm eating had a very different relationship with the city. And which of these relationships are actually being understood? Which of these relationships are we being and having enough courage to unpack and question?
Yes, and actually there's when you delve deeper, there is actually crossover between these separate conceptions of animal use. And I kind of like to draw attention to that animal industrial complex aspect of things that does, when you start to pick them apart, they are not so separate because, of course, as you'll know, many people, there is an underground market for game meat across the world. And zoo animals are often fed to each other when they die. And the lines between consumable and sort of game or entertainment or spectacle, they they start to blur across all of the industries. You can draw lines between the wildlife trade, the exotic pet trade, entertainment, food, hunting for meat. The lines all start to cross, and you can have the same animal even crossing between different ones. You know, a racehorse can shift into becoming meat, and greyhounds can shift from becoming entertainment to pet, but they can also shift to also becoming meat. And when I was thinking about the sort of different materials and technologies that are also made invisible in the normalization of the kind of use of animals, the kind of, as we were saying, the violence that's done to them gets hidden behind these sort of euphemistic representations of their lives and what we do. So I was saying that you've got the literal invisibility and the discursive invisibility, but I think what underpins them is the epistemic invisibility and the ontological invisibility. But so just to confuse things, I think there's also like interweaving through those, because of course, like binary systems of inequality, they're of course hierarchical. There's different levels of inequality, and there's different sort of hierarchies of visibility as well. So some animal uses get accorded more moral concern than others. So particularly now, I would say in the advocacy space, animal agriculture is certainly quite prominent, and food animals get talked about in their sort of the billions that are killed each year, and the acute suffering. Animals that suffer very visibly and acutely physically are often very prominent. But what I would say are perhaps less visible, or should be just as morally visible but aren't, are other types of suffering, like psychological and also ontological suffering again. So the suffering of animals that are kind of dislocated from kin or prevented from experiencing any kind of stability or community for their entire lives can be 15, 20, 30 years or longer, I think should be considered just as morally significant as those of animals that are produced and killed so much more quickly in their billions. But for the individual animals, the experience of physical, psychological, or ontological suffering is just as equal, and yet morally, I would say what's done to food animals receives more concern. Not that it's been having much effect, but I think there's a risk that in sort of not paying attention to these other forms of suffering, we're sort of saying that there are certain relations and uses of animals that can be benign and benevolent. Mm-hmm. And so if we just made the way we treat food animals more like that, then use per se is not the problem.
Yes, I guess that also underpins a lot of kind of welfare ways of thinking about animals. So I guess what you're saying here is there's a problem in kind of creating a poster child out of these relationships. So we're using our human relations with agricultural animals as a kind of poster child for trying to understand many of our problematic relationships with animals that need to be better visibilized, better made visible and also understood, whether they be the ways in which we watch them, the ways in which we keep them in our homes. How do these relationships impact the animals physically and acutely, the way you mentioned, but also their sense of self, the sense to which they are able to actually navigate the world and be? How does this actually alter their world? And there are many ways in which this manifests, and I think eating them is one. But as you said right in the beginning, and here again, you know, how they're kept in zoos, how they're kept in aquariums, how they are managed in homes, in laboratories, these are all spaces worthy of consideration. But something you've brought up in almost all of these spaces that seems to cut across is the idea of commodification. That commodification is somehow central to both the ways in which they're made invisible, but also the reasoning for why they're invisible, or why they're even in these relationships in the first place. So perhaps we could just spend a little bit of time talking about that. What do we mean when we say commodification? What are we talking about here? And what is its relationship with this kind of invisibility tension?
Well, I'm not a huge expert on kind of Marx theory, but commodification is when the a certain value is put on a quality of an animal, a monetary value. So some aspect of that animal's way of being, whether it's to do with their body or their living body or their dead body, is seen as of value to it is assigned some value by us as humans, because we see something in it that we derive benefit from, whether that's as food or as pleasure or entertainment. And so that aspect of the animal, its ability to, whether it's its ability to metabolize food in order to grow bigger, or its ability to run fast, or its ability to look a certain way or act a certain way towards us, that is commodified and translated into a monetary exchange value.
And so the animals are reduced to nothing but financial game.
Yes.
To what extent can we extract financial value from you, your body, or what you can do?
Yes. And so as soon as that enters into it, then the equation becomes about producing as much of that mm-hmm. as you can while reducing the costs surrounding it.
Mm-hmm. And this is the critical failure. Sorry.
No, you go.
I was going to say, this is just the critical failure of capitalism, no matter whether you're looking at it from an ecological vantage point or a social one, and there I'm talking about humans and animals, that if you're constantly trying to just produce more, what are the ramifications of that?
Yes, and that profit imperative, it's infuses everything, every sort of use, even ones that people view as benign, and that's the fundamental problem that should be as equal focus as, say, the suffering of animals or the physical suffering, I should say, because that commodification it just drives the production of more life, as much life as possible, so that the value can be taken out, mm-hmm. The best value can be taken out. So you see it in the racing industries and horse racing and greyhound racing. An expose here a few years ago exposed that about a third of greyhounds born every year are killed, or culled, as the industry will say, it's about the same proportion in horse racing, because so many of them just do not make the grade, that to arrive at the few that are profitable, you just have to go through so many who are just not considered valuable. And many of those simply, this is another aspect of the literal invisibility, many of those do simply disappear because there's such a big gap between those born and those actually registered. There's a huge shortfall, and they simply disappear, and they're not traceable. And the same profit thing goes.
Sad.
Yeah, the same goes for zoos and breeding programs, because they can't breed from the same kind of genetically connected stock for too long. They have to go through regular culling, killing each year. So just in European zoos alone, there's about, I think there's about 4,000 to 5,000 animals that are killed every year just as part of keeping the genetic lines pure. And that's just in Europe, that's just in registered European zoos, not unregistered ones. So there's a lot of invisible kind of management going on behind the scenes of sort of perceptive kind of industries that are perceived as benign or even actually
positive.
So
sometimes when I have a conversation with folks about zoos, oftentimes this kind of breeding program will be brought up. You know, zoos are investing a lot of resources into understanding these animals. They're investing a lot of money into conservation. And I think what you're talking about here is kind of what is the motive behind whatever this relationship is? And if the motive is profit, what does this mean? How does profit drive the actions? And if the motive is conservation, what does this mean and how does it actually manifest in the relationships that we see? And as you spoke about there, if genetics is the goal, what does this mean for the actual relationships? Who are the individuals that are getting, you know, pushed around? How much semen is being sold and to who? How are bodies being shipped across the world and across cities? Because it's not just actual animals themselves that are moved, but then parts of them become valued.
Yes.
I do bits of reading about cows and you have to marvel at how much more valuable in a profit sense the semen of a bull is than an entire cow. And even those are just kind of invisible. The sexualized relationships of, this is something Catherine Gillespie does really well, where she kind of talks about the sexualized relationships of animals. But I'm going off on a tangent. I apologize.
No, you're not. I was going to mention some similar things that happened to the greyhounds and the horses that are used for racing that I've tracked as well. Similar things happen. Their life trajectories. They can go through many different trainers just in 2-3 years, 8-9 trainers. But then at some point in their lives, the question of what their value is, they're no longer valued for racing. And so often it's their breeding becomes the next valued commodity. And so, and their semen can be frozen. It can be used after they've gone on to another use. One dog I was following ended up being shipped to China for breeding, but his semen was used here in the UK and Ireland for a while after he'd gone. So there's this sort of invisible trace of these animals.
We straddle it. I find it infinitely interesting and infinitely sad at exactly the same time, because at no point is this horse or this dog or this cow being viewed as a horse or a dog or a cow who has any sort of life of their own, who has their own life history. And if you start to pay attention to what that life history is, I think it gets crushing. But you're speaking here also, I think, really about trying to understand and make visible not just specific animals, but problematizing some of these relationships and what that act of problematizing them does, how it works to make both the animals and some of these relationships visible. I have two more questions before we head over to your quote. And the first one is just trying to bring the urban back into this. So we've unpacked now a fair bit about how this works to make both animals as physical, lively beings absent, as well as the relationships we have with them invisible. But why is focusing on the urban in particular for animal studies scholars? Why should the urban in particular be a space where they concentrate their efforts? Why is this of particular concern?
I think I can only speak for what I notice. And what is, I guess, is a concern for me, and others might disagree. But I think, as I said at the beginning, I think the urban is a place where we have a lot of these animals that are just not paid attention to. They are so much part of the wallpaper of our lives. And I think these relations need to be examined just as much as relations elsewhere that are problematized. I guess it's part of that odd equation of thinking that greater visibility will lead to more concern, when it's actually conversely just as true that often it's very invisible relations with a nature that's on the other side of the world that is actually given more moral weight. And yet it's in cities that some of the most undesirable aspects of our relations with animals exist. Like, there's so many research, like academic research centers, whether it's schools of medicine, university departments, and medical research centers. There's so many hundreds of thousands of animals that are hidden behind those doors. You've got your rescue centers, as I said, and racing tracks and zoos. So the presence of all of these very non-native animals within our cities is not considered unusual, or it's considered just as part of everyday life. Mm. But I think we need to start thinking about those relations differently in order to start unsettling the whole kind of foundation of what we think of as a healthy relationship. So it's almost starting with our everyday instead of these relations that are all almost kept a bit distance from us, like it's the food animals and it's nature and we've got to help the stop the deforestation in Amazon. It's like bringing it a lot closer.
I do think that food animals are really important. I think that does come to the everyday that you're talking about, kind of the taken for granted everyday thing that you do. You eat three times a day. It's mm-hmm. something you take for granted. You put on makeup. How are animals implicated in that makeup? You go on a day trip to the zoo. What does this mean? And just as you were speaking, I was thinking, again, and I think it's going to come up a lot in this season, is this idea of the city being a human space. And we kind of constantly reinforce this idea, the city is human, even though we, you know, you think for a minute and you realize, yes, okay, there are other animals here. But I think the extent to which there are just other animals here is not really appreciated. And it would be fascinating to see a census document of an urban area that included other animals, where you actually got a sense of how many animals are we really talking about in this urban space? If we were to calculate all of the lab rats and the monkeys in the labs and the animals in the zoos and, you know, the backyard chickens and the dogs and the cats and just the live animals in a city that are kept in some way. In the previous episode, I spoke to Nicholas Delon about the idea of pervasive captivity, that animals are just kind of kept in a variety of different ways. And even those that are not forcibly kept in some way end up relying on the urban as a space. But imagine if we created a document that was able to actually highlight these animals and kind of give a true sense of just how animal a city is, and that we could start to look at these relationships.
I tried to do that for the paper. I looked at Melbourne, just Greater Melbourne. And I tried to do that for various industries, the horse racing, greyhound slaughterhouses. I drew on various documents and tried to provide an idea of just how many animals we were talking about. And originally I really wanted to sort of start doing it for lots of cities. Mm. So I tried to do it just for Melbourne.
And was it a hard activity to just get these numbers, to figure it out?
Yes, it can be really hard, especially for animal research labs. There can be so many of them that you don't know about, I come back to the pet industry, but that's one of those. For me, I'm starting to realize the pet industry is just one of the biggest black boxes, because you can't actually, unlike others where undercover footage is starting to emerge and some industries have to make annual reports. I mean, what goes on behind people's doors is totally unknown. And I was reading the other day that in the UK, there's 9 million dogs, pet dogs, apparently. But they, a conservative estimate says that there's about 7 million reptiles. And that's only reptiles. So the volume of exotic pets and the lives that they lead behind people's doors, mm-hmm. And the networks and trade routes that they're caught up in, that's another aspect of the urban.
And what does the urban owe to them as animals now? Once they enter, once they're there, is it really only just a matter of welfare policy? It's hard. It's definitely hard, and it's definitely complicated. Do you have a quote that we could listen to and chat about for a little bit before we close up?
Yeah. So in terms of quotes, I actually chose two, and one of them I used in my book on ethical and sustainable meat, and it still just has such a resonance for me. It's from a book of fiction by Emma Gean, and the book's called The Many Selves of Catherine North. And in this book, the book is about her imagining a sort of world where tourism has reached such has become so technologized that people can actually travel in other animals' bodies, so they can have a phenomenological experience in other animals' bodies. And so what one line that she says is, other subjectivities aren't a consumer item. Their habitats aren't playgrounds. And so that for me just kind of sums up everything.
Could you say it one more time? I mean, that whole concept of that book is mind-boggling. Can you say it one more time?
The quote?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's, other subjectivities aren't a consumer item. Their habitats aren't playgrounds.
Yeah, it does. I think it's speaking to the trivialization, right? The trivialization of a being or of where their home is. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And you said,
our sense of entitlement, I guess it speaks to that for me, is our just sense of absolute entitlement to invade and appropriate their lives, mm-hmm. whenever it suits us.
Yeah, that's powerful. You said you had a second one for us?
Yes, and this one's from Dinesh Wadiwal, and I guess it speaks more to that idea of invisibility and the normalization of violence towards animals. But and in using the word violence, I'm thinking of violence more broadly than mm-hmm. just sort of physical acts. But so he says in his book, The War on Animals, The War Against Animals, he says, we live in a world where violence towards animals is configured as non-violence and where forms of violence are rendered as beneficent. So
And what type of violence is acceptable or not acceptable? This came up a lot in season one when we were speaking about animals and the law. You can't inflict unnecessary harm on an animal. That's it. But what is constituted as necessary or unnecessary? And this came up a lot in the legal episodes, how the idea of necessity is really blurry and vague and used in a variety of ways to use animals' lives in any way we want. We can use it as long as we somehow figure out, is it necessary to know their DNA and their genetics? Yes. So we can, we can invade their reproductive lives. Is it necessary to make money so that our economies stay afloat? Yes. So we can do with animals whatever we like. As long as we can find a clever way to make what we do to them necessary, then,
The recent Animals Manifesto that was made, produced in relation to, as a response to COVID, as part of United, the Environment Day last year, I think, it used similar language. It said it separated essential from non-essential animal uses. And that was a manifesto that was signed on by a multitude of welfare and rights organizations, mostly welfare organizations. But yes, it had that same idea of essential and non-essential use.
You have to ask yourself, what does that work do? What do those words do and for who? Because Yeah, need is not as definitive as we might like to think. Need and what we think we need is also a socially constructed thing. And in thinking about cities as well, you know, what do cities need and how do we view cities as growing in the future? And what do we imagine our future cities need? And something I know you'd mentioned in the papers, there's a lot of talk now about like green spaces and creating urban gardens and, you know, trying to reanimate the city. But what do not only future cities, but cities and the environments that they're in relationship with need is actually a really open question.
Yeah, it's again, it's part of that discursive process of invisibilizing certain, not just certain animals, but certain ways of thinking about them. It provides a ready narrative that excludes other ways of thinking about them. So critical thought's kind of curtailed.
It's not always easy to think a new thought. It does require some struggle and some discomfort and kind of... that if it's easy to understand and comprehend, maybe there's a point at which you need to stop and say, okay, why is this so easy? Why am I so readily willing to accept what this narrative is, what this idea is? And that maybe in looking at, like you said earlier, looking at kind of the taken for granted every day, you start to realize that we have a script that we kind of just go along with. And only once we start to turn and look at that script, whether it's on ourselves or the institutions that we're part of, and we see that uncomfortable thing and we have to struggle with it, maybe there is the space for new thought or new ways of potentially conceiving our worlds and our cities.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I was going to say something similar right at the beginning of the interview. I forgot, but the idea that focusing on invisibilization, it's shining, kind of illuminating these kind of shadow spaces, because I think we need that as a constant check on these dominant narratives, like you're saying, like challenging that normalized way of thinking. And I think like looking at these shadow spaces can to some extent guard against that. It kind of stirs up notions of what's acceptable or normalized. Maybe guards against some of that, the potential of some perverse outcomes of thinking, well, if invisibility has led to this, perhaps more visibility will solve it. And I don't think that's been proven to not necessarily be the case. Yeah. So I think you need to be more careful and really look at what is happening.
Yeah, sometimes the answer isn't just obvious, but the process of questioning what currently exists might be.
Yeah, and it can feel like you're being a Cassandra sometimes and sort of a why, you know, if something's good and yet you've pointed out the bad thing about it. But I don't see it as that. I see it as seeing it as we could be better, like this is fine, but we're still not including them. So we need to, it's not criticizing, it's just seeing room to bring more along and see how the conceptualizations could be improved.
I love that. Before I say goodbye to you today, I just want to give you an opportunity to maybe tell folks about what you're working on right now and maybe point them to a place they can get in touch with you if they're interested in your work.
So if people do want to check out my work, at the moment, I moved here a year ago on a fellowship looking at, I was particularly interested in looking at what I'm calling spectacularized animals. So I was going to look at the way animals are visually consumed. So I guess I looked at the literal consumption in my last project, and I'm kind of interested in their visual consumption there. So I was looking at greyhound racing, horse racing, zoos, and agricultural shows as spaces where people go to sort of have certain conceptions of animals affirmed. And I see these as spaces where those conceptions are continually reinforced. So I was interested in understanding how these spaces are constituted and how the animals that are used in them are constituted by the people that go. So how visitors understand and make sense of the animals, what it is about them that they like watching, and I guess how they, what function that activity serves in their lives. And so I had a whole load of research outcomes planned. I was going to visit the sites and look at the infrastructures of control and containment, because that's another aspect of visibility that I didn't raise, is the all the invisible tools and techniques of control and containment that are an aspect of most of the animals we've talked about lives. That I was going to be looking at all of those techniques and infrastructures at each of the sites, the tethers, the cages, the ramps, the hours, and and looking at the actual time, the actual experience of the animal, how many hours they spend in different places, who they come into contact with, what's their experience, how far do they travel. So I was looking at all of that, but of course with COVID it just cancelled a huge element of my research. But I have been speaking to people that visited these sites at least before lockdown and sometimes during for zoos, kind of planning to speak to people involved in the background of the industry to get a better sense of what the routinized lives of these animals actually is, sort of the mundaneness. So that's another aspect of invisibility that I hadn't really thought about now, but where the really prominent aspects of some lives are focused on, sort of the animals used in agriculture and their abuse and mistreatment, I started to become interested in that routinized suffering, that just the hours that they spend. For example, greyhounds are legally allowed to be left for 23 hours with no human contact. And the zoo animals that I've been watching, those 6 hours that they're open to the public, that all the other hours of their days that they spend in these spaces is largely invisible. Where they came from is also not questioned by people that go. What happens to them, what the animals that die aren't really, you don't hear about that, because I discovered that two of the animals I was interested in had passed away, they said, the year before without any explanation. And the fact that they can spend 20, 30 years in that same cage. I mean, so when people go and watch these animals for sort of 30 seconds or a minute for greyhounds, or they pass by the zoo cage maybe maximum 30 seconds, and yet the whole entirety of these animals' lives, it's that mundaneness that I wanted to explore.
Yeah, that's one of you. I mean, it's tragic, actually, because when you start to just accumulate those hours, like you said, those moments of acute violence and that fear, I think, are real and significant. But there is something crushing about just thinking, like you said, I remember as a child going to the zoo and seeing bears in the zoo, and you could see just in that moment that the bear was not happy. I was a child, but I could tell just by the pacing of the bear. I didn't know anything about animal studies. Bear was just pacing up and down what was in effect a concrete square. So even when they're exposed to the public, the level of interaction with other beings, any sort of, and I know it's a lot has changed in zoos since I was young, some zoos at least, but you add that up over a life and it starts to become just, I mean, we think now about COVID and how people have started to feel a little bit bonkers when they're told to stay at home for 2 weeks. Now imagine being, an intelligent being kept in a concrete square, not for 30 seconds, not for a day, but for 30 years. It's beyond imagination.
Yeah. So it was that kind of experience of the psychological and ontological violence that I wanted to bring out, because I think it's just as significant as the physical violence, especially for prolonged times. And often the other aspect of is the continual, what we would describe what some studies might describe as the lovely relations, say with horses or with dogs. For many animals, those relationships are severed continually and maybe several times in their lives. They get passed from different owners, or they get abandoned, then they get adopted again. So I guess that trajectory of their lives that we also don't see from their perspective.
No, I mean, I know my own doggo, Linus, we adopted him when he was 11 months. Still a youngster, right? 11 months is, and he had been in four or five different homes before he reached us at 11 months. And you've just got to think, what underlies that kind of assumption that you can just get rid of? And I do think maybe folks don't always have a clear understanding of the responsibility involved in having another being in your life, and the money and the time and the dedication, and that this being is a person in your family now and you need to take responsibility for them. But the ease with which people will introduce pets into their home to only get rid of them when they become a nuisance or a problem, I think, I can't remember what study I read, but I think it happens often around Easter. Everyone decides to go and buy a bunny rabbit because it's Easter. And then shortly thereafter, there are just rabbits being donated to welfare organizations because people don't want them anymore. They realize that a rabbit's not an ornament. They have needs and wants and things they'd like to do. Anyway.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's the kind of, it's some of that, those are the kind of ways that we use animals that I think are morally less visible. They do get accepted a lot more.
Yeah, they're a bit more sidelined. Well, thank you so much for all of the work you've done and the work you continue to do. I will definitely keep reading your papers, and I hope to keep our conversations going. If folks want to reach out to you, do you have an email address, or are you on Twitter or anything like that?
Yes, I'm on email. It's my surname and my initial. It's rkarip@edgehill.co.uk. I am on Twitter, but I'm not an active Twitterer. I just have it mainly to do work things.
Okay.
And it's rainfed5, @rainfed5 is my Twitter handle. But I'm not a big social media person.
I'm figuring out most guests aren't. Everyone kind of ends off with saying, I need to get better at it, but it's not my priority, which I think is totally fine. Well, thank you so much for joining me today and for what was really a great conversation. I learned a lot from you, and I really look forward to talking to you more in future. So thank you.
Yeah, no, I really loved talking to you, and I hope I got across some decent ideas.
Welcome to the Animal Highlight. In today's highlight, I'm going to be talking about rats. But before I start rambling about how amazing rats are, I thought I'd read a short excerpt from the book Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches and Rats, Pests in the City by Dawn Day Beeler. One of her chapters is focused entirely on rats, and the opening page of this chapter is kind of an excerpt about rats during the Great Depression in the United States. Okay, here we go. This is my first time ever reading on a podcast, so wish me luck. A Norway rat emerged from his burrow as dusk fell over Baltimore's east side on an early spring evening in 1937. The air carried a scent of food, as well as scents of people, dogs, and cats. The high board wooden fence surrounding the backyard provided reliable shelter from these minor threats, despite its ramshackle condition, perhaps because of it. The rat's grey-brown fur brushed against the fence as he trotted along it, retracing the greasy line left a few inches above the ground by generations of his kin. He poked his nose under the fence, testing the space with his sensitive whiskers. His whiskers barely grazed the boards, signaling to him that he had more than enough room to pass through. On the other side, the rat found the neighbor's back stairs, atop which sat a bucket of kitchen scraps, its contents lean in these hard times, waiting to be dumped in a busted wooden barrel by the alley. The rat had seen this bucket there before. If he had not, he would have approached much more tentatively. His wariness serves him well. New objects in the environment could be traps or poisons. One of the larger rats on the block, he easily reached the first step with his front paws and bounded up crooked wooden stairs until he reached the bucket and tipped it over. Another large male rat joined him, and the two licked juice from crab shells and nibbled at the tiny scraps of meat left inside. Suddenly, the light came on in the kitchen, and a small dog barked from inside the back screen door. Startled, the rats reared up and squealed. The dog retreated, and the rats fled. They jumped down to the ground, scurried across the yard, and squeezed under the fence and into the alley. Many of the block's 200-some rats departed their burrows after sunset to eat, drink, and mate. Across the alley, a pregnant female lapped at a tub where rain had collected during the morning shower. She had given birth to 5 litters of 6 to 9 young in the past year, but many of her pups died from disease, starvation, or predation. A young rat peeked out from under the rotted and gnawed bottom of a privy shed door and ducked back inside upon seeing a cat peering down from the back porch. Large adult rats had little to fear from dogs or cats, however. Another young rat gnawed with her strong jaws and ever-growing teeth at the edges of a hole in the wooden platform of the back porch, enlarging the hole just enough to squeeze inside. Several rats made their homes in the house's cavity walls, rotting floors, and crumbling cellar. They enjoyed better access to stored food than their outdoor cousins, for the pantry consisted of open shelving without cabinet doors. They also transmitted fleas, mites, parasites, and bacteria to one another more easily than their backyard cousins. Indoor rats faced more frequent confrontations with human residents, which often proved fatal for rats and sometimes injurious, infectious, or deadly to people. So I really just love that excerpt because it places rats at the center of that urban story, and you kind of get a sense and a feel for how rats navigate the city, what they're doing in their day-to-day lives, what their schedules are, who their families are. So with that in mind, here are some just interesting facts about rats. So rats are primarily nocturnal animals. Their teeth never stop growing. Their whiskers are extremely sensitive, and one of my favorite words of all time is thigomaxic, which means that they brush along, they use their whiskers or their bodies to brush along walls to get a sense of the place. They have amazing senses. So rats' eyes can move in opposite directions. They have an exceptional sense of smell. In fact, they have over 1,000 olfactory receptors. To give you a sense of what that means, humans only have about 400, and dogs have just over 800. So because of this, rats have been used in a variety of settings. They've been used to work in clearing landmines in Mozambique, Cambodia, Zimbabwe, and Angola. And they've also been found to more quickly and more accurately identify TB than those working in a lab. And above all else, rats are extremely social animals. They live in small groups. They mourn the death of someone in their group. They're prone to depression if they don't have friends. And they're also prone to peer pressure. And cleaning is a really important social bond. So even though people think rats are really dirty, in fact, they're extremely clean and they'll spend hours and hours a day just cleaning one another. So yeah, there are some really interesting facts and tidbits about rats. They are animals you don't necessarily see every day when you're walking in the city, or maybe you do, I don't know. But I hope that you now think of rats as being much, much more than an animal that is associated with the bubonic plague. They have long, long histories stretching much further back than the Great Depression, and they just got a lot of interesting stuff going on. All right, that's it, everybody. Thank you once again to Paul Okari for being a fantastic guest, to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law, and Ethics Apple for sponsoring this podcast, to Jeremy John for the logo, and Gordon Clark for the bed music. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hurtenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.